As we know, in a few days, we have the auspicious appearance day of Lord Krishna, Janmashtami. So I'll read something about Krishna here. The title of the lecture was, Why the Unborn Takes Birth. And this is from one of Queen Kunti's prayers in the first canto of the fifth chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Queen Kunti says, Kechit ahor ajam jatam punya shlokasya kirtaye yado priyasyan vaye malayasyeva chandanam. Some say that the unborn is born for the glorification of pious kings. Others say that he is born to please King Yadu, one of your dearest devotees. You appear in his family as sandalwood appears in the Malayan hills. Srila Prabhupada's purport, because the Lord's appearance in this material world is bewildering, there are different opinions about the birth of the unborn. In the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says that he takes his birth in the material world, although he is the Lord of all creations and he is unborn. So there cannot be any denial of the birth of the unborn because he himself establishes the truth. But that is also declared in the Bhagavad Gita. He appears by his own internal potency to reestablish the principles of religion and to protect the pious and to annihilate the impious. That is the mission of the appearance of the unborn. Still, it is said that the Lord is there to glorify the pious king, Yudhisthira. Lord Sri Krishna certainly wanted to establish the kingdom of the Pandavas for the good of all in the world. When there is a pious king ruling over the world, the people are happy. When the ruler is impious, the people are unhappy. In the age of Kali, in most cases, the rulers are impious. And therefore, the citizens are also continuously unhappy. But in the case of democracy, the impious citizens themselves elect their representative to rule over them, and therefore they cannot blame anyone for their unhappiness. Maharaj Naila was also celebrated as a great pious king, but he had no connection with Lord Krishna. Therefore, Maharaj Yudhisthira is meant here to be glorified by Lord Krishna. He had also glorified King Yadu, having taken his birth in the family. He is known as Yadava, Yaduvira, Yadunandana, etc. Although the Lord is always independent of such obligation. He is just like the sandalwood that grows in the Malayan hills. Trees can grow anywhere and everywhere. Yet because the sandalwood trees grow mostly in the area of the Malayan hills, the names sandalwood and Malayan hills are interrelated. Therefore, the conclusion is that the Lord is never unborn like the sun. Conclusion is that the Lord is ever unborn like the sun, and yet he appears as the sun rises on the eastern horizon. As the sun is never the sun of the eastern horizon, so the Lord is no one's son, but he is the father of everything that be. Kechit ahora jam jatam punya shloka sikirtaye yado priyasyan vayaye yado priyas Yan vavaye malayasyeva chandanam. Some say that the unborn is born for the glorification of pious kings, and others say that he is born to please King Yadu, one of your dearest devotees. You appear in his family as sandalwood appears in the Malayan hills. Namo Vishnu Vraya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Tanamane. Namaste, Sarasvatam Deve, Gauravani Pacharne, Nirvishesha, Shunyavadi, Paskyadhyade, Satarne. As Yamaraj once said, some may say that they know Krishna. Even Vyasadeva may or may not know Krishna. Yamaraj may or may not know Krishna. As for myself, I don't really know Krishna. Even Lord Brahma, who is the creator of the universe, He thought at one time that Krishna was just an ordinary cowherd boy. Similarly, Indra thought that Krishna was an ordinary cowherd boy. So what to speak of our little selves? What kind of conceptions do we have about Krishna? Although we may be officially Krishna-conscious devotees, but Krishna's activities are not so easy to understand. First of all, it says that he's unborn. Now, generally speaking, we don't find so many people unborn. Most people have a father and mother, which is natural. And that's also one of the proofs of the fact that there must be someone who's the supreme, and he must be a person. Just like nowadays they say that all of us came out of monkeys. Well, the fact is that Darwin may have come from a monkey, but the rest of us, it's very unlikely we came out of monkeys. And what's the proof? That each one of us had a father and mother. And our fathers and mothers also had fathers and mothers. And their fathers and mothers also had fathers and mothers. Now, where in the history of our family tree do we find that one of our great-great-grandmothers or great-great-grandfathers happened to be a monkey? Does anyone know anyone in their family who is a monkey? Maybe a little brother or sister looked like a monkey or acted like a monkey. But ultimately, they probably wouldn't be classified in that particular species. And if we look at the monkeys, their family history, it's very unlikely we're going to find out that one of their great-great-great-grandfathers or grandmothers happened to be a sheep. From monkeys generally come monkeys, from sheep come sheep, and from nothing comes nothing. If the origin of everything was supposed to be nothing, then why isn't more things coming out of nothing? Nothing was nothing in the beginning, and when it created everything, it was still nothing. So if it could create everything out of nothing, why doesn't it create more things out of nothing? But we don't find universes flying into existence out of nothing. Matter of fact, we don't get anything from nothing. If you go to the store and you say, I have nothing, but can you give me everything? People ask you, well, why don't you try to get something before we can give you something? Or the scientists say that everything came out of nothing. So if everything came out of nothing, why are they working so hard to get their PhD degree? Why don't they sit at home and out of nothing they can get their degree? Why are they working so hard to get money if the whole universe came out of nothing? Why don't they sit at home and by chance or out of nothing, everything will come? So they don't believe their own philosophy, because their philosophy came out of nothing. Well, it came out of the space between their ears, and in there was practically nothing. That's the only place where we find a void. So the fact is that all of us, we came out of persons. We came from persons, and the original person, here it says, is unborn. As a matter of fact, all of us are unborn also. Although it appears that we've taken birth, we've actually only appeared here. Just like, as the example given here, that the sun arises at a certain time on the eastern horizon, but no one thinks, or very few people think, that the sun was born from the eastern horizon. And when the sun goes down in the evening, most of us don't think that the sun has died and has been buried on the western horizon. We know the sun, when it appears on the eastern horizon, it's not actually being born, it's simply appearing to us. And when it goes down on the western horizon, it's not disappearing, it's just disappearing to our eyesight. Similarly, the soul and the supreme soul don't take birth in this material world because they're eternal. They only appear. So we may appear to take birth in a certain family, but before that we were in another family. Similarly, the Supreme Lord takes birth, but the difference is he takes birth by his internal energy. So he never is part of the material energy. His activities are all divyam, or transcendental. And why does Krishna take birth? He says, paritranaya sarunam vinashayatri dispritam dharma samstapanartaya sambhavam yuge yuge. We can read about Krishna's activities from the point of view that he comes millennium after millennium for the same three purposes. Namely, to protect the pious, to annihilate the miscreants, and to establish religious principles. Now, our choice is, if we accept religious principles, then we can be on Krishna's side. And if we don't, then we're against Krishna. That's our choice. It may appear that we have many choices. Yes, within the illusory energy, apparently we have many choices how to be against Krishna. But everyone is more or less trying to imitate Krishna in a way that makes them believe that they're actually becoming a small Krishna, but this is all part of the illusory energy, because the soul never becomes part of the material energy. It's always transcendental, beyond the material modes, and is not actually affected by what's going on in the material world. Except, it's allowed to dream that it is taking part in material activities, and it is becoming more or less an enjoyer or a sufferer in the material energy. So we're allowed to take part in this lila called the illusory energy and imagine ourselves to be going through so many transformations while we still remain the same soul who's sleeping in Maya. But when Krishna comes, he's not sleeping, he's awake, and his activities are all meant for those three things in order to teach us how to wake up. Krishna only comes to help us wake up. He has no other reason to come here. The prasadam is not any better here than it is in the spiritual world. He doesn't need a vacation. He doesn't have, you know, time off 120 years to come here. A vacation. Usually he goes to Croatia, but sometimes he goes to tries to go someplace where it's sunny and there's a beach. No, he doesn't come for that because he's perfectly happy in the spiritual world, but he comes here in order to wake up the souls. Jeev Jago, Jeev Jago. But he doesn't force the souls to wake up, because waking up means to develop love for Krishna. And love is something voluntary. We can voluntarily love Krishna, or we can voluntarily choose to ignore him. That's our choice. So Krishna doesn't want to interfere with that choice, so he doesn't come as the Supreme Lord and tell everyone, here I am, surrender. No, he comes as seemingly, for most people, an ordinary personality. And his energies are such that everyone can believe whatever they want about Krishna. When Krishna walked into the arena to battle against the wrestlers, then everyone in the audience saw Krishna differently. If you did an interview for a newspaper about the wrestling match, Krishna versus Kansa's wrestlers, you get quite a varied opinions about what happened. The ladies in the audience who were seeing Krishna, they saw him as Cupid personified. The kings, they saw him as the most strongest ruler. Kansa saw him as death personified. The wrestlers saw him like to be like a thunderbolt. The fools, they thought him to be like a fool, like themselves. Mother Jasoda, Nana Maharaj, they saw him as the most beloved child. The Yadus saw him as the most illustrious ancestor. So everyone in the audience who saw Krishna, they saw him differently. Just like when we come and see the Panchatattva, They reciprocate with each one of us differently. Now, if the Panchatattva suddenly revealed to us who they actually are, it would spoil our material lives. We'd go home in ecstasy, but we'd be quite disappointed. We wouldn't know how to break it to our family or to our relatives or our parents. They'd say, well, I actually believe in Krishna now. And they say, oh, no. What happened to you? I'm so sorry. Are you sure you can't forget? Well, they revealed themselves to me. Oh, anyhow, so many people reveal themselves. Just try and forget it. It'll go away. So Krishna doesn't so easily reveal himself, because once he does, then we can't forget him. And if we don't want to remember him in the first place, why would he force us to remember him by showing us how beautiful he was, how strong he is, how attractive he is? Matter of fact, those who saw Krishna like Kamsa, instead of becoming more attracted to him, they became more envious of him. Even the wrestlers, when they saw Krishna said, actually, I'm just a little coward boy. Me and my elder brother were just coward boys. And although the king has called us here to wrestle against you, but actually it would be unfair, because all we do is we play around with our own friends in the forest, but you are big, strong wrestlers. But Mushtika, Toshala, they said, my dear Krishna Balaram, actually we know who you actually are. You're the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You're the one who create and destroy all these universes. So it behooves you to fight with the strongest of the wrestlers, Mushtika and Chanora. So that's called Maya. Imagine you're an ant, and suddenly this 18-meter-high person comes to fight with you. And then you're a little ant. You say, oh, that's right, I'm not afraid. You can hit me first. So you must be insane to challenge someone who's thousands and millions of times bigger than you are. So similarly, that's Krishna's illusory energy. Not only Mushtika, Charnara, Toshala, and others were under that illusory energy, but all of us were under the illusory energy. And therefore, we're thinking, oh yes, Krishna may be a little bit more powerful than I am. Or maybe he might even be real, who knows? He may even exist. But he can't be as great as they actually tell us he is. Besides that, look at his activities. When he was a child, he was born in a prison. His parents were all criminals. So what kind of god is he? Not only that, but after he escaped to Vrindavan, as soon as his nurse came to feed him, he killed her. So what kind of supreme person is this? And then we look at his activities. He grew up. He created a mafia in Vrindavan. And they went around. They spent their childhood stealing from all the neighbors. And then even when he was young, he's still a boy, somehow or another he attracted all these ladies, all these young girls, and he played around with them. As soon as they got serious, he fled. And then he went to Mathura. The first thing he did is he killed an elephant. He was killing so many things in his childhood. He killed a snake. He killed a calf. He killed a horse. He killed a bull. He killed a bird. His life was spent killing things. And then as soon as he got to Mathura, he killed his uncle. Dangerous person. Then he fled, because he made so many enemies, he fled into the ocean, and they followed him there, and he'd just come out of and he'd harassed the people who came to visit him. Many times he killed them all. Then he went around stealing these ladies. He even stole 16,108, 16,000 queens. and hid them in the sea. So, he may be God, but what kind of God is he? So, if we take Krishna's activities like our activities, then we'll become bewildered. We'll actually think that, why is Krishna doing all these things? Why did he kill all these poor animals who came to visit him in Vrindavan? Why was he, everything he got his hands on, he stole? So one would be bewildered and not understand how everything Krishna does is to please his devotees. And besides that, our Krishna actually didn't even kill these animals. Of course, they weren't just animals. They were big demons disguising themselves as animals, ferocious demons. But Krishna didn't even kill them because we have to understand that Krishna is always in the mood of Vrindavan. But in order to take care of his different activities outside of Vrindavan, Krishna expands his personality in different forms, and just appropriately he can perform different activities. Similarly, when Krishna comes here and takes birth, along with him come his different expansions, who perform his different activities, so that Krishna can come here and simply be a little child of Mother Jasoda. And although he may kill a big witch called Putana, Krishna is not even conscious of what's going on because it's his expansion of Vasudeva who kills the demons. Krishna always remains in that mood of Vrindavan where he's enjoying, and his different expansions don't really change their mood either because they're not an illusion like we are. We think that if we kill something, it's dead. But as I've said many times, actually nothing ever dies because the soul can't die. It can change its situation where it thinks it is, but it actually is eternal. So when Krishna Vasudeva kills a demon, actually the demon becomes liberated, becomes benefited at least. It's like a child, it's like the father slapping a child for the instruction of the child. Not to hurt the child, but to benefit the child. So Krishna is slapping Putana or Agasura or Trinivarta or any of the other demons is not out of enmity, but simply to assist that particular soul to wake up. And nor does Krishna kill anything or anyone, because the body can't die. The body is already dead, so something that's already dead can't die. If you have a costume of Dracula, you went to a costume party, and you had a costume of Dracula, and you come home and you think, this personality of Dracula is very bad, I should never play Dracula, and you take a gun and shoot the costume. Well, the costume doesn't die. You can't kill Dracula, the costume, because Dracula was never alive. Similarly, this body that we're in is not alive. There may be living entities within the body that are alive, including ourselves. The souls in the body make the body appear to be alive, but actually the body is always dead. So when this body supposedly dies, it never died, because it was never alive. Just like a puppet. You may have a puppet, it may appear to be alive and doing so many different things. And if you take your hand out of it, then the puppet falls on the ground and everyone crowds around and says, I think the puppet's dead. And they look up and they say, did it have insurance? And everyone's going, call 911. It won't revive. It's definitely dead. Okay, we'll have to bury it. They put in a little puppet box and they have a funeral procession to puppet graveyard and everyone's crying. It was such a nice puppet. Made all the children happy, but now it's dead. They say nice things about the puppet and then put it into the earth. So this is all illusion because the puppet didn't die. Similarly, no one dies. Therefore, Krishna doesn't kill anyone. But he elevates people by his association. Those who are against Krishna, sometimes they have the fortune of getting Krishna's association. And they learn, like Haranyakashipu, or Shishupal, or Dantavakra, or others, Ravana, Kumbhakarna, they learn that if you're not God. Now their lesson is very fortunate because Krishna comes personally to remove that misconception. They're very, very powerful. And therefore when they meet Krishna in some form, they learn that they're not the most powerful. But we ourselves, we're simply being confronted with Krishna's energy in the form of time. And we don't realize actually we're fighting against time or Krishna, and we always lose. Now some people, they become very powerful, and it becomes a big burden. Because they're getting the same thing anyhow, whether you have $100 or you have $1 billion, basically speaking, the same activities are there for everyone. In the material world, it is simply the same thing over and over again. People get up in the morning and they eat, they sleep, they mate and defend. Now, if you have many, many things to help you eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, then it becomes a big burden to eat, sleep, mate, and defend. As I've told the story, there was one Brahmin, he only had a pair of underwear. He was very renounced, but he was very Krishna conscious. So one day he was bathing in the Ganges, and he took off his underwear to dry it on the ground. But one cat came and stole his underwear. So he was very ashamed, embarrassed, and he had to beg another set of underwear. And then he vowed he'd never be put himself in such a position again. And so he begged a cat in order to protect his underwear. Now he didn't realize at the time, but actually cats need things like milk. So the cat kept on meowing, and he went on the internet to find out what the cat was saying, and he found out that the cat was asking for some milk. And then he had further research on the internet to find out where milk comes from, and he discovered it came from cows. Luckily, being a Brahmin, he could go to the place where they had cows, and he begged a cow so he can give the cat some milk so he could protect his underwear. But then he couldn't figure out how to milk the cow because it was too technological for him. He never went past kindergarten. So he went on, did further research, and found out that generally women know how to milk cows. So he got a wife. So the wife was milking the cow so he can get some milk to feed the cat who protected his underwear. But lo and behold, the lady wanted some children. But in order to have children, he needed a house. So he had to get a job. So now he had a job and a wife and two children and a house and a cow in order to protect his underwear. But he realized that actually in order to pay off the house, he needed a car to go to work, and so he had to work at night. So now he had two jobs. He had a house, he had a wife, two children, a cow and a cat protecting his underwear. So they realized things were getting so complicated, and eventually he wouldn't be able to maintain his underwear anymore, so he threw it away and walked away. So we may be envious of people who have more material opulence than we have, but actually at the end of the day, all they can do is the same thing we're doing, namely eating, sleeping, mating, defending. There's not much more to do around here. But the difference is if you have a lot in order to maintain your eating, sleeping, mating, defending, it's quite anxiety. If you have one car, you have to put in so much effort for the insurance, for cleaning the car, protecting the car, the gasoline, etc., to maintain the car. Now, if you have two cars, you have to put in twice as much effort in order to maintain them and provide for them. So the more you have, the more anxiety you have. And then at the end of leaving this body, you're much more attached to an ordinary person, because an ordinary person has practically nothing to lose, but you have so much to lose. So you become 100 times more attached to what you have. One time Prabhupada was walking in Switzerland, and he went by a house, and everything in that house was perfectly arranged. Every leaf on the tree was organized. Every blade of grass in the garden was exactly cut to the proper proportions and was lined up with every other blade of grass. Otherwise, it didn't deserve to be in that house. Everything was perfectly painted and maintained, and Prabhupada's remark was, this person is a very unfortunate person. He's so attached to his house that if he's impious, he'll have to come back in that same house, but not necessarily as a human being. Maybe as a mouse in a perfect house. Every endeavor we're doing here in order to progress actually puts us back something. Because we have to, at the end of the day, the more attached we are to our conveniences and our accomplishments and everything that goes along with our effort to make our better material existence, will wind up working against us in the long run. So Krishna comes and tells us that this is not our home, and he shows us something what our real home would be like. First of all, he shows us if you become a demon, then you lose. Either Krishna, if you're fortunate, comes and personally kills you, or Krishna in Bhagavad Gita says, time will take everything away. Mrityu sarvaharastraham. We may not believe in God, as Prabhupada said. We may not believe in Krishna. We may decry Krishna and his activities. But at the end of the day, everything Krishna will take everything away in the form of time. We may not bow down before Krishna when we're in this body, but eventually when we leave this body, the body will be forced to bow down. And everybody, as Krishna said, is changing all the time, and that change means that it's not getting younger. I don't think any of us are claiming that now I'm 20 years younger than I was 20 years ago. Now, every moment, every day, and every second, this body is getting older, which means it's getting closer to its disappearance. And although everyone chants and sings sometimes happy birthday, no one sings happy death day. Happy death day to you. Because death means losing everything we have, unless one takes Krishna seriously and understands his transcendental activities and realizes that that is my real place, to take part in Krishna's transcendental activities. And such activities are eternal. As it says, both with the rising and the setting of the sun, every person, his duration of life is being lost, except for the person who is glorifying the personality of Godhead. Because as he becomes absorbed in Krishna consciousness, then he enters into eternity. So Krishna's activities are supposed to be attractive. He dances with 16,108 gopis, and he lives with 16,108 queens, because if Krishna was just like everyone else, then it wouldn't be very attractive. But a person who can live simultaneously with 108 queens, or as Prabhupada said in one lecture, they accuse Krishna as being lusty, but if he's lusty, he's unlimitedly lusty. He's unlimitedly everything. He's said to be unlimitedly beautiful, unlimitedly strong, unlimitedly wealthy, unlimitedly knowledgeable, unlimitedly renowned, unlimitedly famous. So Krishna comes and displays these activities, but in the internal energy, not just any activities, not just any energy, but in the spiritual energy to attract us so we can think that there's an alternative just by spending eternity eating, sleeping, mating, and dying. Come back to do the same thing all over again in 8,400,000 species of life. Now we may think that's nice, but that's the illusory energy. As I said one time, Prabhupada was going to a doctor's appointment in Los Angeles, and he, on the way back, he came past the movie theater, and the title of the movie was, Is There Sex After Death? So Prabhupada came back and gave his regular lecture in the morning in Los Angeles. And he mentioned, he said, I was on the way back from the doctor's, we passed by this movie theater, and the title of the movie was, Is There Sex After Death? At that time, most of the devotees would go out and book distribution or Harinam, and they meet different people. So Prabhupada told them, when you meet people, you should try to help them become free from anxiety. You should tell them that they don't have to worry, that there is sex after death. And 8,400,000 species of life. And Prabhupada said, if you tell people that, then they won't be afraid of death anymore. So material life is centered around things that are rather, according to spiritual understanding and spiritual experience, insignificant. But this is given to us, and if we want to enjoy this material existence, we can stay here forever trying to get some pleasure from the material energy. And there, undoubtedly, there is something called happiness. People identify with happiness. Otherwise, people wouldn't stay around here. But compared to Krishna's activities, they're considered to be insignificant. And the nice thing about Krishna's activities is we tell people about Krishna, even we tell people that you're not this body, your body's changing, but you're not changing, that this knowledge is self-evident. It doesn't require any scientific investigation. It doesn't require any experimentation. It's self-evident for one who actually hears with the right attitude from this right source, it all becomes revealed. That is, one can realize for oneself one's eternity, the fact that one is eternal, immediately, just by hearing from a devotee, if someone has the right attitude, one can realize that they're eternal. But one should realize more than that, otherwise one's life will be wasted. As I said before, one time I was distributing books at the University of Austin in Texas. There's a place in Austin right by the university, and the devotees used to go out there every day and distribute books to the students who were walking by. And one time I met a student, and I gave them a book. And in the Bhagavad Gita, there's a picture of the changing bodies. And I used to point out to the students, here is a 5-year-old body, here's a 15-year-old body, and which body do you have? So the student pointed out in the picture in the Bhagavad Gita, I have this body. So I said, but actually you've had so many bodies and you'll get so many bodies, but you haven't changed. I said, well, then you're right. Actually, I'm not this body. I'm eternal. Wow, that's fantastic. So I said, well, why don't you take the book and give a donation? But he handed me the book back. He said, I don't need the book, but wow, that philosophy is great. Thanks a lot. And then he left. Never saw him again. So it's not enough to know that we're eternal. We should also understand what we're supposed to be doing eternally. We're not supposed to be here in the material world trying to imitate Radha and Krishna. We should find out who the real Radha and Krishna is. Instead of imitating them, we should participate in their activities. Even in this world, by the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates, we can take part in Krishna's activities by engaging in chanting Hare Krishna, especially in the Sankirtan movement. So Krishna is unborn, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his associates are unborn, but they come here, they appear here, that the sun appears on the eastern horizon, just to give us an activity, the opportunity to engage with them in their eternal activities of Sankirtan, glorifying the Supreme Lord. And if we do that, then our lives will become successful, and we'll be able to help other people make their lives successful also. So I'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions?
Could I just ask why are sometimes different people attracted to some forms, incarnations of Krishna more than to others.
Because everyone has variety is the, as it says, the mother of enjoyment. So everyone likes variety, and there are different souls. They have different tastes. They have different likings. Just like some people like, if they go to the movies, some people like horror movies. Some people like romance. Some people like comedies. Some people like adventure, because they have different tastes, different likings. So the spiritual world is like that too. Krishna comes in endless varieties so that people can participate in endless different activities with Krishna, according to their taste.
So do we reach the same results, the same eternal results, if we are attracted to different forms of Krishna? So is it important to which form of Krishna are we attracted, or is that is the result the same no matter which form are attracted to?
Well, we should avoid the universal form, the ghastly form of Krishna in the form of time. The other ones are right. They're all, it's just like you may have the Himalayan mountains, they're all more or less pretty high, compared to where we're at now, they're quite high up there. Now one may be 100 meters higher than the other and it's considered taller, but ultimately they're all amazingly tall. So Krishna's incarnations and his different expansions are all unlimitedly attractive. But according to one's taste, one may become attracted to one, someone else may become attracted to another, but they're all equally auspicious. Anything else?
When we speak about karma, we usually speak about body you get, the things that happened around us or to us, but it's also our level of consciousness also connected to the karmic, like the way we see things, we see.
Yeah, for one who sees things as they are, then the influence of material nature ceases. It's like if you're dreaming and you wake up, then you won't be affected by the dream. You may be remembering the dream, but you're not attached to the dream. So one who's awake, he sees the world as it is, as Krishna's pastime, but the pastime of trying to wake up the souls. But if he's already awake, he won't be influenced by the material nature the same way that everyone else is influenced by the material nature. In other words, for one who's not being pushed by the senses or bewildered by the mind, when he sees the activities of the material nature, he's not bewildered by them. And he can perform his service to Krishna even while in a material body undisturbed. And he simply acts under the internal energy and performs the services of Krishna that Krishna desires. Nimitra matram bhavasava sachin. Krishna tells Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, just get up and prepare to fight, and after conquering enemies, you'll enjoy a flourishing kingdom. There you're put to death by my arrangement, and you, O Savasachi, can be but an instrument in the fight. So a devotee is awake, he sees that Krishna is in control of everything, everything is going on perfectly, and therefore he's not disturbed under any circumstance, but simply does the service that Krishna wants him to do, undisturbed.
Before you spoke about where we came from. What do you think about Richard Dawkins' theory about selfish gene? What are your thoughts about this book?
I have no thoughts about it whatsoever. I haven't read the book. I have no intention of reading it. But what does he say? What does he say we came from?
He's explaining it that we came from the prasup.
Which, from the soup. Who stirred the soup?
Yeah, it's a chemicals and molecules. 4 billion where they come years
from?
Ago.
Where did they come from?
I don't know.
Who stirred them? Where did they go? Someone drank it?
The evolution, the Darwinism.
Yeah, what do I think about it? I think it's crazy.
Thank you.
As it says in Mangal, it's like a mad, just like a goat can eat anything, so a madman could say anything. All right, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.